Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. 50 people have reportedly been killed in Syria after Islamic State militants captured part of the northern provincial capital of Hasakha. Witnesses also report the extremists executed 20 people near the town of Kobani, close to the Turkish border. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Civilians fled fighting Thursday in the northeastern Syrian provincial capital of Hasakha as Islamic State militants made inroads into the city. Syrian government forces control southern portions of the city, and Kurdish militia fighters control regions to the north. Rami Abdulrahman of the London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights insists the battle for Hasakha continues. He says that Islamic State has taken control of part of the city of Hasakha for the first time, including the districts of Nashwa and Sharia, but that fighting and clashes are continuing. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A senior U.S. State Department official says negotiators trying to reach an agreement about Iran's nuclear program may not complete their work by a June 30 deadline, but they expect to be close. Secretary of State John Kerry is returning to Vienna Friday for the final phase of the talks aimed at reaching a comprehensive international agreement on Iran's nuclear program. Afghanistan's intelligence agency has blamed Monday's attack on the Afghan parliament on the Haqqani network, as well as an officer of Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI. 35 people, including 5 women and 3 children, were wounded. This is VOA News. Niger's army says it has killed 15 Boko Haram militants in land and air operations and taken another 20 captive. In a statement released on state-owned radio late Wednesday, Niger's defense ministry said soldiers destroyed an armored vehicle and 26 motorcycles in the operation. The ministry did not give the exact location of the military activity, but Boko Haram has been active in Niger's southeast, near Lake Chad and the Nigerian and Chadian borders. Crucial talks between Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras and European officials resumed Thursday afternoon in Brussels in hopes of achieving a bailout deal to save Athens from default next week. Talks among Eurozone ministers ended hours earlier Thursday with no deal for Athens to get a desperately needed installment of a European Union bailout. The talks quickly fell apart Wednesday when neither side had a deal the other was willing to accept. A default could force Greece out of the Eurozone and shake up European markets. Greece Prime Minister Tsipras had planned to meet late into the night with Greece's creditors, but those talks also ended earlier than expected, neither side making any comment. Greece must make a nearly $2 billion loan payment to the International Monetary Fund by next Tuesday. Nigeria's new president will meet with U.S. President Barack Obama next month to discuss the fight against militant group Boko Haram and other crucial issues. The White House said Thursday that Mr. Obama will host President Muhammadu Buhari at the White House July 20th. A statement says the two leaders will discuss ways to advance a holistic regional approach to combating Boko Haram and important economic and political reforms in Nigeria. Mr. Buhari's senior advisors are to meet with their U.S. counterparts as well. President Buhari was inaugurated last month after defeating predecessor Goodluck Jonathan in the March election. The election marked the first peaceful transfer of power in Nigeria since the country returned to democracy in 1999. Mr. Buhari has vowed to stop rampant corruption in Nigeria and defeat Boko Haram insurgents who have killed thousands of people since 2009. Myanmar's parliament has dealt a significant blow to opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi's chances at becoming president, rejecting a bill that would have ended the military's effective veto power over constitutional changes. The longtime democracy leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner said she was not surprised at the results of the vote, which followed 3 days of emotional debate by her fellow lawmakers. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhiban coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Italy has for many years considered each time the influx of migrants and refugees as an emergency and had ad hoc responses and never tackled the problem, the influx, as a structural problem. Which means that you have a system that is not responding to the needs.
That's Monwi Moncada of Doctors Without Borders talking about overcrowding in Italy's network of migrant centers. Details coming up.
Also, South Africa says it may withdraw from the International Criminal Court after controversy arose over its refusal to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. And the government of Burundi says the second vice president has fled the country.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, South Africa says it may withdraw from the International Criminal Court after controversy rose over its refusal to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir on genocide charges. A government spokesman, Jeff Radebe, made the announcement today after a cabinet meeting, saying a withdrawal would be a last resort after a review is made of the Rome Statute that sets out the guidelines for the ICC. President Bashir was in South Africa last week for a two-day meeting of African Union heads of state. Under the Rome Statute, South Africa could have arrested him as he is wanted by the ICC on genocide charges. But while a South African court considered the matter, Mr. Bashir defied an order to remain in South Africa and instead returned home to Khartoum, putting him out of reach of South African authorities. The South African court handed down the order for Mr. Bashir's arrest just hours after he left the country. Mr. Bashir is wanted on charges of war crimes and genocide related to the ongoing conflict in Sudan's Darfur region. The United Nations estimates some 300,000 people have been killed and more than 2 million displaced by the violence.
The government of Burundi says the second vice president has fled the country. A special advisor to President Pierre Nkurunziza confirmed in a Twitter message today that Grévis Rufukiri has left Burundi. Rufukiri told Radio France International yesterday that he escaped from Burundi in fear for his life after opposing Mr. Nkurunziza's controversial bid for re-election to a third term in office. Rufukiri's current location is not known, but he is believed to have sought refuge in Brussels. Thousands have fled the country during weeks of political turmoil that has spread from the capital Bujumbura to some rural areas. More than 70 people have died in violence in the capital.
The European Commission has been planning to divide more than 40,000 asylum seekers among members of the European Union, but diplomats say the plan will likely be rejected by the 28 countries of the EU. Member countries meet today to once again debate the controversial migrant proposal. At least a dozen countries oppose a quota system, and others want to change the proposal. The Commission hopes to resolve the issue by the end of July. The quota proposal addresses only a portion of the more than 100,000 migrants who have sailed the Mediterranean from Syria and a dozen African countries in the first half of 2015.
Doctors Without Borders says Italy's migrant reception centers are severely overcrowded. The international medical charity attributes the problem in part to Italian municipal governments, which provide migrant services. A Doctor Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, says governments treated the 2014 migrant flow as one-time emergency and were not prepared for more of the same in 2015. Manu Monacada is the organization's operations director in Southern Europe. The EU funds the migrants' center, but he says most of its actions are designed to block further flaws rather than serve the needs of the hundreds still landing on Europe's southern shores. Monacada spoke with VOA's David Arnold about the migrant reception centers in Italy.
In Greece, clearly there are no reception centers that are working, especially in the islands along Turkey, where we see a massive influx of migrants and refugees. We are present in one of these islands named Kos in Dodecanese Islands, and basically there is no reception center, there is no reception at all. Whereas in Italy, you have reception centers, but they do not fit the volume of activities. Italy has for many years considered each time the influx of migrants and refugees as an emergency and had ad hoc responses and never tackled the problem, the influx, as a structural problem, which means that you have a system that is not responding to the needs. And we are present in one of these centers, which can host about 150, 180 people. Well, last month, 50% of the time it was overcrowded, with peaks up to 580 people in one day. We are present in one of them, in a place called Pozzallo. Last year they received about 25% of all the arrivals, this year about 20%. So it's the major harbor where the boats are arriving with refugees.
What are the problems?
If you have an overcrowded center, you have a center that can host 150 people, so you have a certain number of latrines, of showers, of dishes, meals that have been supposed to be distributed. Let's say a contingency plan that has never been rolled out, if there was any. And that is one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that you have standards linked to these reception centers. For instance, you need to provide legal counseling, legal advice to these migrants that arrive. You should be able to perform vulnerability assessments, which means identifying women, children, minor, unaccompanied minor, elderly, and treat them according to their specific needs. And then you have substantial percentage of the people who arrived, and when they arrive, they are clearly have been victims of violence, victims of torture in their country of origin, and so they have developed a series of mental health needs that needs to be responded to. And this is totally absent. So you have huge gaps in these centers, which are even more, let's say, overcrowded. It's a long process. It's not a very fast-track identification or a fast-track process. It takes weeks, if not months, very clearly overwhelmed by the number, which, by the way, is exactly the same number than last year. So it's not that it's brand new as a fact. So Italy and Greece had years to be prepared to this, and definitely they are not. And that's why you have MSF, Doctors Without Borders, responding in an exceptional manner to this.
How many migrants are just drifting around the country looking for a way out?
Difficult to answer with figures, but we can say that there are thousands.
Assuming that the numbers continue and possibly increase over the summer, what is the solution to the problem?
First of all the measures that up to now the EU has decided are not measures that are responding to the needs, but are more measures that are meant to stop the flow, stop the influx of refugees by all means, and then to increase the security and the control. So there are dozens of thousands of people that are waiting to leave in the north of Africa or in Turkey, and will pass the border despite the control that one can make.
That was Manawi Monacada in Geneva talking about migrant centers in Italy with VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C.
The United Nations says it has started an emergency program to distribute planting seeds and medical aid as a food and health crisis looms in northern Cameroon. The region is hosting thousands of refugees and people internally displaced by Boko Haram fighting. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yaoundé.
Najat Rushdie, coordinator of the United Nations Systems in Cameroon, says the needs of about 50,000 Nigerians seeking refuge from the Boko Haram insurgency in Cameroon has continued to increase. She says the refugees need more food and medical care now that there is a food crisis and a cholera epidemic looming. So they have decided to launch emergency aid programs to support the refugees.
The assistance is different component. The first one is, of course, about the food distribution, but you have done also seed distribution in order to rehabilitate the local agriculture. The assistance is also about access to water and sanitation. You know, the rainy season is starting, and obviously we need to make sure that there is this access. Without this, there is a risk of having a huge cholera outbreak. It's also about health services and health support, and of course, an important psychological support because of the trauma they have been through, and support to the education and local economy rehabilitation, and all what is related to early recovery.
This year, the United Nations announced that it had requested $71 million to assist displaced people in Nigeria and neighboring countries, but had received less than $7 million in donations. Rushdie says they urgently need the assistance to support host communities that are now struggling with limited resources.
We need to remain vigilant. It is very important that we all mobilize ourselves, our partners, our donors, in order to provide those communities and to provide this population with the best assistance possible. There is a real trauma among this population, and it's so important, actually, that we also show solidarity the way they did vis-a-vis the people they hosted.
Esime Menye, Cameroon's Minister of Agriculture and Rural Development, told VOA they have been distributing planting seeds to farmers in host communities to improve production and reduce the effects of a looming food crisis.
Having seeds, it's not a guarantee. You may have very good quality seeds, but you need also to use them properly. So we have explained to our people in the field to tell farmers to first keep them in water for one night before planting.
Cameroon estimates, in addition to the Nigerian refugees, there are over 100,000 internally displaced people in the country, and says the figures have been stable since the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram staged a large-scale attack in the country last February. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehili Suhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. South Africa says it may withdraw from the International Criminal Court after controversy rose over its refusal to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. And the government of Burundi says the second vice president has fled the country. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A new report in the medical journal Lancet says as many as 74,000 people in Guinea did not seek treatment for malaria because they avoided clinics with Ebola patients. The report says it is difficult to determine how many people may have died of malaria. However, it says the number must be higher than the 2,400 who died of Ebola in Guinea. Malaria is the leading killer of children in Guinea. An estimated 15,000 people died of malaria in 2013, prior to the Ebola outbreak. Health workers reported many people with malaria were afraid of catching Ebola at a medical facility or being mistakenly sent to an Ebola clinic. Health officials also worry the Ebola outbreak may have caused a drop in vaccination coverage, putting Guinea at risk of a resurgence of diseases like measles and polio. The research was paid for by the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and the U.S. President's Malaria Initiative.
A new report says critical decisions by African leaders helped turn the tide in West Africa's Ebola outbreak. The Tony Blair Africa Governance Initiative, or AGI, says there is no substitute for political leadership. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Writing in the AGI report, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says it's critical for people of the Ebola-affected countries to have a stake in their own futures. She says that governments should steer the course, but everyone must take a turn to row. Dan Heimowitz is head of the British Charities Insight and Learning Program and co-author of The State of Emergency, How Government Fought Ebola.
We worked in the three countries on the Ebola response. This is a report that's been developed based on our experience, our work, and what we saw. And what we saw is that while there's a perception out there that international actors, international organizations are primarily responsible for getting Ebola under control, what we saw is that it was Ghanaians, Sierra Leoneans, and Liberians who really stepped up to manage this crisis.
The report cites specific decisions made by the leaders of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. For example, Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma ordered the military to take the lead against Ebola because the Ministry of Health lacked resources.
I think that one was important, just recognizing that this wasn't purely a health challenge. A lot of the challenges of managing this crisis was getting the whole system to work. There was a lot of issues around logistics, just getting all the parts working together.
In Liberia, President Sirleaf went against culture and tradition by ordering the bodies of Ebola victims cremated and not buried. She acted on warnings from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the World Health Organization.
This was one of the most frightening and difficult moments in Ebola in Liberia. It was during those very frightening days where, you know, you had predictions of a future of 10,000 cases a day, maybe in January. That's what the CDC and WHO were predicting. And Liberia basically had run out of space to bury bodies in the county that includes Monrovia, the capital of Liberia.
Heimowitz says in Guinea, President Alpha Conde mobilized funds from a tight budget to buy protection equipment and ambulances and pay those who responded to the crisis.
In the early days of the response, before there had been the major international mobilization of resources, you had to find the resources. And again, I think that's another very good example of leadership from the top to get things moving.
The report says leaders are a symbol and must be seen to lead, adding that they can delegate work but not accountability. It recommends that systems and structures be put in place to allow the government to make the right decisions. It says there are two important lessons for effective response. Keep it simple, get it started and adapt it, and work out what information decision makers need. Heimowitz says credit must also be given to local heroes in the fight against Ebola. He gives the example of a woman he worked with in Monrovia.
Very late in the epidemic in Liberia, there was a situation where 30 gang members had been exposed to the disease, and it was a real risk that they might infect others in the city. And it was a young Liberian woman named Priscilla Dyla who was able to negotiate with the gang and convince them to self-quarantine and basically spend the next 21 days in isolation together.
The Tony Blair Africa Governance Initiative also has recommendations for international partners who are also described as heroes. It says that the response was most effective when international partners supported governments' leadership, strategies, and plans, rather than pushing their own. Donors, it says, must be clear about what they can and cannot do, and be ready to adapt to ever-changing situations. AGI recommends using the lessons learned from Ebola to help Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone recover from the epidemic. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Climate change and large dam projects are threatening World Heritage sites. That's the warning issued by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN. It's the official advisory body on nature to UNESCO's World Heritage Committee. IUCN officials say the impact of climate change is already evident in 35 of their 228 sites. In addition, 11 natural World Heritage sites are threatened by dam projects that have reduced natural wetlands, changed river flows, and harmed local communities. Tom Badman is director of the World Heritage Committee. He described some of the World Heritage sites and how climate change is now their biggest threat.
We deal with 228 sites globally that are listed for their natural heritage. So it's a wealth of some of the household names of nature conservation, places like Kilimanjaro, Ngorongoro, the Great Barrier Reef, the Grand Canyon, places like that, but 228 places that are renowned for their outstanding universal value.
How is climate change putting them at risk?
Well, we're concerned about a whole range of different ways in which climate change impacts World Heritage sites. It can be changes in temperature affecting sites, changes in weather like storms and flooding frequency, droughts. For marine sites, we're seeing impacts from the way the chemistry of the oceans can be changing, and we're seeing the natural habitats that they protect shifting as well.
Dam projects are also a very big concern with how they are affecting, I guess, local communities. So how do dams pose a threat to natural wetland areas, rivers, and local communities?
Well, that's one of the points we're really raising this year is the number of sites that we're seeing. We've monitored 55 sites for this committee, and 11 of them in different ways have got issues that come from the construction of dams or work on watercourses. So sometimes these can be smaller scale issues, but the concerns we have are where major changes can result in water bodies, which can impact not just their nature conservation value, but the way in which communities rely upon them.
How are marine and coastal sites, you mentioned they are facing particular challenges. So what are some of the challenges of marine and coastal sites?
So some of the challenges we see, so warming water temperatures in the oceans can lead with coral sites to the coral being bleached. And we also see that ocean acidification, that's the way the chemistry of the oceans are changing, can slow down the way coral is growing. Plus, we see major changes that can happen in terms of weather patterns, the risk of weather patterns changing, being an issue which is affecting marine sites. And so we're reporting on those issues at this coming committee, for instance, with the well-known site of the Great Barrier Reef, which has some of those impacts I've just mentioned.
What would you like to see as the takeaway from the UNESCO World Heritage Committee's annual meeting that's coming up on June 28th?
Well, this is a convention, the World Heritage Convention, that's over 40 years old, and it's been listing sites for a long time. In total, if you add the natural sites we deal with and the cultural sites that are also listed, it's now over 1,000 sites. And our take-home message is we have to really change the focus of the convention from listing sites to conserving the sites that have been listed. So our focus in the future is really going to be how do we make sure all of the World Heritage sites that are protected through this convention are all really in a good state for the future. Right now, we've got a situation where quite a few World Heritage sites are doing well, but it's still only 63% of the natural World Heritage sites that we think have what we would call a good outlook. So almost one-third of the World Heritage list, the sites that are listed, need a really major increase in the performance of conservation plans and the way they're being protected if we're going to be able to hand them to our children and they hand them to their children.
You all also have about 8 World Heritage nominations coming up, and one of them being the Cape Floral Region Protected Areas in South Africa. So what does it take to become a World Heritage Site?
Sites are listed because, firstly, they have an outstanding universal value that's based on their international importance. So you have to have the highest level of international conservation importance. That's not enough to be a World Heritage Site. Sites have also got to have integrity, that means the right places are protected and they're in good condition, and they've got to be effectively protected and managed. So the site that you've mentioned, the Cape Floral Region, is being put forward for an extension of the committee this year. We make recommendations and we'll have to see whether the committee accepts our recommendation, but in this case our recommendation is a positive one, and we think that that extension is one that we would support being included on the World Heritage List.
Tom Badman is director of the World Heritage Committee. He spoke with me from Bonn, Germany.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Africa says it may withdraw from the International Criminal Court after controversy rose over its refusal to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. And the government of Burundi says the second vice president has fled the country. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, Egyptian authorities are on track to open a new Suez Canal by August 6th. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are beginning with pro basketball.
Kim, we're going to tip off in New York City, where the National Basketball Association will hold its annual draft of college and international players later Thursday night. VOA's Tadi Abeje has this preview for us.
The NBA draft is made up of two rounds and 60 picks in total. The Minnesota Timberwolves will pick first, followed by the Los Angeles Lakers and the Philadelphia 76ers. The focus will likely be on the two dominant big men, Karl-Anthony Towns from the University of Kentucky and Jahlil Okafor from Duke University in North Carolina. Okafor is of Nigerian descent. He has great post-scoring skills, and he's been compared to San Antonio Spurs center Tim Duncan. Virtually no one can stop him from scoring near the basket. Okafor and Towns are expected to be the top two picks. Okafor says he always had big dreams of one day playing in the NBA.
Kind of nervous. I don't know where I'm going, but most of all, I'm just happy. My family and I enjoying it. I'm happy, then I'm worried. I don't know where I'm going. So it's just a lot of mixed emotions. But luckily, I have my family supporting me the whole way, making sure I stay level-headed.
That's Jahlil Okafor, one of the two top picks in this year's draft. The other likely top pick, Karl-Anthony Towns, is a player who has a complete all-around game. He can shoot, rebound, and defend at a high level. Towns comes from a Kentucky team loaded with seven talented players who will also be in the draft. His game is often compared to former NBA international player Lotte Divac. Many say Towns has the potential to be the leader of a franchise. Towns talks about his strengths and how he could help his new team.
I just think that's going to be the versatility. I'm just trying to bring versatility. That's always what I focus my game on, is being able to give the coach any options he would like for me to do. If he needs me to guard 5 through 3, switch on a 1, or be able to shoot the basketball or be inside any game. I just want to give my organization and my team the best possible chance of winning.
The other likely top pick in this year's draft, Karl-Anthony Towns. There are also other international players that are expected to be drafted within the top 10 picks. They include Kristaps Porzingis from Latvia, Mario Hezonja from Croatia, and Emmanuel Mudiay from the Democratic Republic of Congo. This year's draft could be one of the best ever. It will take place at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I'm VOA's Tadi Abeje.
Yeah, I'm out that Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pull me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my ties. Sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. I be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely from
New York. Let's hear it for New York. Welcome to the bright lights, baby. New York, the scene for the 2015 NBA draft. Well, our African football guru, David Legg, says teams across the continent have been busy recently playing qualifying matches for the 2016 African Nations Championship, which will be hosted by Rwanda. Just a reminder for our VOA football fans, this competition is for players based in Africa. So, for example, to play for Rwanda, you must play for a Rwandan club. To play for Nigeria, you must play for a Nigerian club. And to play for South Africa, you must play for a South African club. David adds these qualifying matches are being contested on a regional basis, and he looks now at the latest results.
If we look first at the North Zone, now that's the only one that's been played on a round-robin basis. The others are home and away. So far, we've had three matches. They were all played in Morocco. It started with Morocco 1, Tunisia 1. Then we had Libya, the defending champions, 1, Tunisia 0. And then we had Morocco 3, Libya 0. Now, the outcome of all of that, Sonny, is that with two matches each played, Morocco have got 4 points, Libya have got 3, and Tunisia have got 1. Those same three countries will play another mini-league in Tunisia in mid-August. And after that, the teams finishing first and second on the table will qualify for Rwanda. Now, I know some very alert Voice of America listeners are going to say, we've got a mini-league in Morocco, we've got another one coming up in Tunisia. What about Libya? Unfortunately, because of the security situation in Libya, Libya cannot host internationals at this stage. It applies to their national team and also their club sides. So, in fact, Libya being in second place at the moment with 3 points is a really meritorious position for them because they basically have to play their home games away. If we then move on, Sonny, to the west of Africa, there are, in fact, two zones, West A and West B. West B will come later. That involves the likes of Nigeria and Ghana. They will only play in October. The results of the preliminary round first leg matches were Guinea-Bissau 1, Mali 1. Pretty predictable result that, and now you would fancy Mali to advance after the return game. Mauritania 2, Sierra Leone 1. That one is still in the balance. Sierra Leone, unfortunately, because of the Ebola epidemic, they have to play away. Now, whereas Guinea have found in Morocco and Mali neutral venues to play their home matches, Sierra Leone can't seem to do this. They always have to play both their home and their away games at their rivals' ground. And this is what's going to happen, Sonny, on this occasion. Next weekend, the second match will also be played in Mauritania. And on that basis, I suppose the Mauritanians must be slight favourites. Guinea beat Liberia 3-1. Now, that match was played in Mali, again, because of the Ebola epidemic. But the good news for Liberian football supporters, and we say a big hi to them from the sunny side of sport, we know we've got a lot of listeners in Monrovia and other towns and cities in that country, is that Liberia has been declared an Ebola-free zone, and that means that the return match will be played in Monrovia on the first weekend of July, and that's great news, I know, for all Liberian fans. It's going to be a tough task. The encouraging thing is they have scored an away goal, so if Liberia can pull off a 2-0 victory at home in the second leg, they would qualify on the away goal rule. In Dakar, a neighbourly battle, and it was Senegal 3, Gambia 1. Interestingly, in the history of the CHAN, that was the first defeat sustained by Gambia. Then, finally, we move on to the East Zone, three matches here. Tanzania 0, Uganda 3. The result is not a surprise for me, but the scoreline was. I did not expect Uganda to win so comfortably away from home. Djibouti 1, Burundi 2. Again, a pretty well expected result, and Burundi should win the return game as well. And then a huge crowd turned up at Bahir Dar. Now, Bahir Dar is 700 kilometers north of Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, and they're really pulling in the crowds there. Huge crowd indeed to see Ethiopia beat Kenya by 2-0, a goal midway through each half. And that tie set for an intriguing second leg, presumably in Nairobi. On then, Sonny, to the South Zone, and there's always a really good entry. On this occasion, 12 teams. So you had six preliminary round first leg ties. Zimbabwe, who interestingly have the best record in qualifying. They've now won 10 matches and drawn 3, but never lost. They beat the Comore Islands 2-0, but they were only one goal ahead till right at the end when Madewe scored in the 90th minute. No goals in Maseru between Lesotho and Botswana. In Windhoek, Namibia came from behind to beat Zambia by 2-1. Nkankoo, midway through the second half, scoring the match winner there. A big win for Mozambique in Beira, the Indian Ocean port city. They beat the Seychelles by 5-1. South Africa, who've been battling to score, they managed 3 at home to Mauritius, a 3-0 victory there. And then a real thriller in Swaziland. Swaziland 2, Angola 2. Angola built a 2-0 lead, but the Swazis, who never seem to give up, they really are one of the great indomitable sides at the moment in African football. They pulled one goal back midway through the second half, and 7 minutes from the end, they snatched an equalizer. But despite that, the fact that Angola have drawn away and have also scored 2 away goals must make them favorites to win the return match. Those return matches, Sonny, this coming weekend, it'll be Mauritania and Sierra Leone. And then the following weekend, July 3, 4, and 5, will be the rest of the second leg fixtures.
Thanks for that soccer-licious analysis, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Let's open the sunny side of sports mailbag now. I received a nice email from Daniel O'Loughlin, a Voice of America listener in Accra, Ghana. Daniel writes, "Dear Sonny, there I was after church on Sunday, sitting in my car at the Sakumono Market outside of Accra while my wife was buying smoked fish. It was a bit hot in the car. Then I heard a familiar voice say, 'Congratulations to Music Time in Africa for its 50th anniversary from the sunny side of sports.'" Daniel says, "I could feel the love for Africa in your voice, Sonny. We are fine in Accra." Thanks for writing, Daniel, and I hope you enjoyed that smoked fish. My VOA colleague Heather Maxwell, the host of our Music Time in Africa show, also says thanks for writing and thanks for listening. Let's give a sunny side of sports shout out to Michael Ona, who says he listens to the show via Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM in Lagos, Nigeria. Michael also wants to give a shout out for one of the Brilla boys, Murphy Ejemba, and to A-Team. Thanks for listening, Michael. And I want to give a long distance sporty hello to my friends at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM in Nigeria. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahais Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Egyptian authorities on track to open a new Suez Canal by August 6th. And next, efforts to establish free movement of goods and services among African states. But first, some music. Here is Joel of Ghana with One Man Down.
Cruise me around in your car, but thank God I got my own home. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. So why you the envy? Used to pay my bills before, but now I they pay for two. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. Brother man, to the envy. Unya yanka, that they be allowed in it, it's a petty border. But man no be God, man no be God. Stop all the hating. Lie, lie, man just be man, so you never know why. My destiny changing, I'm living so high. Making no envy my sign, because where they bless me. Gunshots. One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots. One man down, oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah. The DJs, they playing my song. The fellas be loving, they hailing my song. The ladies, they dancing, they using my song for their ringtone. You never thought about that. No man stay on top forever. What a
whether you short or you tall, rich or you poor, time keep changing for better, and you can't do nothing about it. Another man rain or fighting, because you know be God, and you never saw me past God. Kadawani, no one on Yabalama. It does it when it feels this right. Don't you say it's never my type. So make you know they look down on another brother man. Let go. Gunshots.
One man down, on to the next man. Oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots. One man down, oh yeah, no gaba.
Said I would shrivel, said I'd be dead if I ever tried to whistle. But hey, who said it was simple? The feds take your bread so you wouldn't make a nickel. You mean I couldn't pick a pickle? Pick words when I could've picked a pistol. A sick verse, the outer cells got him sickle. Blowing all up in your face like a pimple. Now he said, she said he ain't hit. And if he ain't hit, that's cause he ain't rich. And if he ain't rich, check who he came with. I don't play with this, he say and she say, shh. Get off my
one man crown, another man frown. Why? Because him want you down. They say one man crown, and another man frown. Why? Because him want you down. But guess what? Gunshots. One man down, on to the next one. Oh, yeah. One man down, oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. It's not a killer man now, oh yeah, no gaba. Another hit a man now, oh yeah, no turning back. One man down, oh yeah, no gaba. All of them down, oh yeah, no turning back. It's DXGZ.
Without face to the strong. God bless y'all for the support. Or whatever.
Joel of Ghana with one man down.
Well, Egyptian authorities say they are on track to open a new Suez Canal on August the 6th, a project they say will more than double the canal's income during the next 10 years. But as VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Ismailia, Egypt, some analysts say the project alone will not be enough to rescue the country's failing economy.
Authorities say Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi plans to announce the new Suez Canal is open for business on August 6th. At that time, they say, ships around the world will blast their horns in recognition of the event. Suez Canal Authority head Admiral Mohab Mohammed Hussein Mamish says the project will cut the amount of time it takes to travel through the canal in half, lowering costs for shippers. The Suez Canal is a major shipping route connecting Europe and Asia and brought in $5.5 billion last year. The new canal is an expansion of the current canal that will allow ships to pass by each other like a two-lane highway as opposed to a single lane. Less than 10 years from now, says Mamish, the expanded canal will earn $13 billion a year for Egypt. But naval history professor Andrew Lambert of King's College in London says the canal's success will depend largely on the global shipping industry, which Egypt cannot control. Even if it is successful, he adds, he does not think it will be enough to improve the lives of average Egyptians who are suffering rising poverty and prices as the economy tries to recover from the financial and political turmoil between 2011 and 2013.
That's a high-risk strategy, and Egypt is a large, complex country with a very big population. It's highly unlikely it's going to be able to live off the kinds of incomes it will get even from two canals. The costs of governing Egypt are very large. There's major debt problems.
But authorities say the economy is growing and the canal is one of many projects intended to boost foreign investment and generate income. From a boat meandering by construction sites on the new canal Sunday, giant waterspouts are seen slowly raising the level of the waterway. The boat is provided by the Suez Canal Authority to promote the project. Reporters snap pictures while workers drop hints about who may be attending the opening bash. Kings and presidents, for certain, along with hundreds of celebrities. The project was scheduled to take a year, but a year ago, analysts balked at the possibility that it could be finished so fast. And while no ship horns are blowing yet, Egyptian officials are confident that they will be blowing soon. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Ismailia, Egypt.
The African Union has launched its continental free trade area negotiations. The talk seeks to establish free movement of goods and services among African states. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
AU chairperson Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe launched the Continental Free Trade Area negotiations at the African Union Summit in Johannesburg.
Yeah, it's launched. I declare it launched.
Mr. Mugabe said a free trade area is essential in promoting movement of goods and people within the continent. The African Union has set 2017 for the implementation of the free trade agreement. African states are expected to reduce trade barriers amongst themselves by drastically reducing export and import duties and waiving visa requirements in some cases. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta hailed the start of negotiations as a critical step towards reducing poverty and doubling the continent's economic development.
CFTA means Africa being able to be self-reliant. CFTA means the African Union meeting to discuss what to do with our prosperity as opposed to what to do with the problems that we suffer.
The Southern African Development Community, the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa, and the East African Community have already launched a tripartite trade agreement, and African heads of state at the summit have expressed the hope the continental negotiations will run smoothly. AU Commissioner for Trade and Industry, Fatima Aksai, says the continental body is aware of the challenges of negotiating such an agreement.
There are some rich resource countries, there are some landlocked countries, there are small island countries, but we know with your political will, we know with knowing the benefit of the continental free trade area, we will prevail and we will surprise the world. So the continental free trade area will happen.
Africa's growing population is estimated at 1 billion people. The continent is also known for being rich in mineral resources. But for the countries to be able to trade with each other from Cape to Cairo, billions of dollars will be required to build a strong rail and road infrastructure. Countries will also have to agree on product quality to ensure a general standard for manufacturing goods being traded. Key will be protecting countries with weaker economies from having their manufacturing industries strangled by economic giants like South Africa and Nigeria. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehizu Ibn Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. According to the State Department's annual terrorism report, in 2014, weak or failed governance continued to provide an enabling environment for the emergence of extremist radicalism and violence, notably in Yemen, Syria, Libya, Nigeria, and Iraq, said U.S. Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism, Tina Cadenow.
We're deeply concerned about the continued evolution of the Islamic State of the Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, the emergence of self-proclaimed ISIL affiliates in Libya, Egypt, Nigeria, and elsewhere, and tens of thousands of foreign terrorist fighters who are exacerbating the violence in the Middle East and posing a continued threat to their own home countries.
Although al-Qaeda's star continued to fade as its central leadership has been weakened, it nevertheless still served as an inspiration to its affiliated groups, including al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which operates in Yemen, al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, al-Nusra Front in Syria, and al-Shabaab in East Africa. Terrorism is a global phenomenon, and no country can fight it alone. The year 2014 witnessed a powerful regional and international mobilization to counter ISIL that halted the group's initial advances in Iraq. The adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 2178 in September 2014 constituted a significant step forward in international efforts to cooperate in preventing the flow of foreign terrorist fighters to and from conflict zones. And to counteract ISIL's spread, the United States is forming partnerships such as the Counter-ISIL Coalition. Today, that coalition consists of over 60 contributing partners, working not only to stop ISIL's advances, but to halt the flow of foreign terrorist fighters, disrupt ISIL's financial resources, and counteract its messaging and undermine its appeal. Partners in North Africa and Asia also took steps in 2014 to strengthen their counterterrorism capabilities through new laws and the development of other means to identify, interdict, and prosecute foreign terrorist fighters and those who support them. Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates have all enacted legislation or regulations in 2014 to address foreign terrorist fighters. The United States and its partners will continue to battle terrorist activity, mitigate underlying conditions conducive to the spread of terrorism, beef up border security, and strengthen weakened institutions. We are intensifying our efforts because this is a battle we plan to win.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.